Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and every week the team and I will be bringing you an exciting mix of discussion, interviews and stories. This week we discuss our Len McCluskey interview, in which the Unite leader warns Ed Miliband against seduction by the Blairites. I ask whether tattoos will ever hang in the loop. We talk spring books with our culture editor Jonathan Derbyshire, hear about America from our US writer Nikki Wolfe, and we follow up on the role that Reddit played in the hunt for the Boston bombers. I'm joined by our political editor, Raphael Baer, and the editor of The Staggers, George Eaton, to talk about the week in politics. We're going to start off with the fact that, George, you interviewed Len McCluskey of Unite, the union, who provide 28% of Labour's funding, and he had some fairly harsh words for the Blairites in the cabinet. He named Jim Murphy, Liam Byrne and Douglas Alexander. What have they done to annoy him?
Well, I think his concern is that they will take Labour into a position that he defines as austerity light, where they either match the spending cuts the Tories are planning after the next election, or introduce significant cuts of their own. It was a very significant move for him to widen his attack on the Blairites. It's not the first time he's attacked that wing of the party, but to start naming members of the shadow cabinet personally and basically saying to Ed Miliband, either you should ignore these guys or you should sack them. Was quite a bold move for him to make, and I think that's why Ed Miliband has come out so strongly and used the word reprehensible, which for a mild chap like Miliband is fairly strident language.
Wasn't it? Were you surprised by how kind of aggressive that comeback was?
I was surprised, because I think Len is not someone that Ed can easily dismiss out of hand, because as you said, that it's the party's biggest donor. He wouldn't have won the leadership without the support of unions like Unite, the party members, and the PLP voted for David. But I think the reason he felt it was necessary is because he couldn't be seen to tolerate a trade union leader basically calling him for him to sack members of his shadow cabinet.
I guess he feels he can't afford that any kind of whisper of Red Ed or any of that can kind of come back.
Exactly. And the Blairites are increasingly anxious about their position in the party, and this was a signal for Miliband: there are lines I will not allow the unions to cross. And although he may have disagreements of his own with some of these figures, he's not prepared for them to just be sort of spat on by the Labour left.
And Raph, there's been a lot of unsolicited advice for Ed Miliband in the last couple of weeks, some of it delivered in the pages of New Statesman, for example Tony Blair's intervention in the centenary issue. How much of it are they listening to?
I think now Ed Miliband's office, mm-hmm. I think they're taking it pretty seriously because they're not unaware that, you know, deep down their poll lead is based heavily on the coalition and government getting things wrong. And I mean, there is ultimately the direction of the party is driven by Ed Miliband's core analysis and his belief in what he thinks needs to be done. But there's only so far that can take them. They still need shadow ministers to come up with, you know, things to do in health, what a one nation health policy, what a one nation justice policy, what a one nation welfare policy would look like. And George is absolutely right. If the impression is given that, you know, Ed Miliband is essentially front of house, but really Len McCluskey is calling the shots, it's properly damaging for the Labour Party. I think also something that's going on in the background here, which is worth considering, is that since David Miliband essentially retired from frontline politics, said he was leaving Parliament, Him being there, although it was sort of awkward and inconvenient for Ed, it was also, there was a sort of brittle fixedness to the situation that meant that Blairites weren't coming out too hard attacking Ed, partly out of sort of loyalty to David in a way. I mean, Ed was still his brother. They didn't want to cause trouble for David.
But also presumably the idea they didn't want to kind of feed any king across the water.
Exactly. And so that there was a sort of a lid on some of this stuff on the right of the party. But also now that David's gone, there's a feeling around that some of the people on the left of the party, and also some of the people who were sort of Team Gordon back in the old Vendetta feud days, are thinking, right, well, that's the sort of one leading, in quotes, Blairite out of the picture. Now maybe we can just get rid of all of them. Not physically dispatch them, but really kind of take away Blairism at the knees. And a lot of people in the parliamentary party are very worried about this, the sense that behind the scenes there's a stitch-up going on, which is essentially trying to snuff out that whole way of thinking in the Labour Party, whether it's Progress, the sort of groupuscule that does a lot of Blairish thinking, all these things. And so I think that anxiety has now filtered up to Ed Miliband. He realises that this looks like a kind of purge of the right, and that smells terrible to people who think Labour should be about plural politics, and that's why he came out very hard and slapped it down yesterday.
Which leads us nicely into the news we've had about the Tory policy unit. So Joe Johnson, the younger brother of London Mayor Boris Johnson, is going in as the head of that, along with some more new, young intake. Is that reflective of a shift in thinking in the Tory party?
I think it's acknowledgement by Cameron that the number 10 operation has been up to scratch. So since the coalition came to power, that policy unit has been headed by a civil servant rather than a political appointee. And Cameron recognises now that's something he's had to address. And by bringing in also people like Jesse Norman, it's a signal that he, rather than dismissing his backbenchers in the way he has sometimes appeared to do, he needs to actually work with them. And I think there's a sense as well that he's capitalising on the unity that has emerged among the Tories since the death of Thatcher.
Mm. It's quite a comeback for Jesse Norman, isn't it, who was sent to Siberia slightly last year.
Yeah, after leading the Lords Revolt.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that I think is quite remarkable. You couldn't have had someone who was more explicitly banished and sent out and told never to come back, because he basically ran a parallel alternative rival whipping operation to the government one over Lords Reform. And he had a stand-up row with the Prime Minister about it afterwards. So to be told you're sort of back in the fold, that is a serious control alt delete moment in terms of David Cameron's relations with his parliamentary party.
And what do we know about Joe Johnson? He was an FT journalist and is pro anti Europe.
Closet pro European. I mean, essentially, is my understanding of it. I mean, pro Europeanism was described to me by one Conservative MP as the sort of the love that dare not speak its name in the parliamentary party, and right. I don't know. I can't claim to know Joe Johnson's mind exactly on this, but someone who will have to remain anonymous, who is pro-European and a serious figure at Westminster, told me of Joe Johnson. He's eminently sensible. He gets it. Now, this accolade coming from this particular person is not something Tory Eurosceptics want to hear. So that could be an issue.
And the other thing to mention probably is that he's another old Etonian.
So is Jesse Norman.
So that'd be a sort of little school reunion for them, which is lovely. And we talked a little bit earlier before we came on air about Linton Crosby and his effect on Tory strategy. And I wonder if, Raf, if you could just tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, Linton, the Labour view is that this is a terrible mistake. Linton Crosby is a sort of deranged right-wing fanatic, and he'll lead them off into the sort of wilderness march of nasty party rhetoric. I think that's a misjudgment. Crosby is there to win. He won't just rerun the 2005 general election campaign, because that lost, and he makes his money by winning campaigns, and he will have learned the lessons from that, and he will take a lot of message dictation from Cameron and Osborne up to a point. Crucially, what Crosby's arrival has done is given Tory MPs the feeling that there's someone in number 10 who actually really wants to win this thing. Because as George was saying, there was a feeling that the number 10 machine, it was full of these sort of flimsy civil servants who were just passing through, and Cameron's posh chums who were sort of preening themselves and playing at statecraft. And actually what you need is someone who just wakes up in the morning thinking, how can I screw Labour? And that person is Linton Crosby.
And finally, GDP figures plus 0.3%. George, George Osborne, great Chancellor or the greatest Chancellor?
It is good for Osborne. A triple dip would have been very, very embarrassing, would have made it a lot easier for Labour. This means that growth, however anemic, and it's worth pointing out it was 0.2% above the forecast, which is also helps him, allows him to maintain this narrative that the economy is healing. And the hope among the Tories, the fear among Labour, is that if you now have a sustained period of growth until the election, and it's possible that you will, then that will look like an achievement compared to the years that we've had. And the Tories will go to the country in 2015 and say, look, we've got the economy growing again, we've got the deficit down. Yes, it hasn't come down as far as we'd like, but who do you want to finish the job? Stick with us. And actually, that's what McCluskey was saying to me. He feels if Labour doesn't offer a real alternative, then that message from the Tories will start to look very appealing. And this is where Ed Miliband's going to have to make a huge judgment on what he does on spending. Does he match the coalition's plans? If he outlines his own alternative, what cuts does he make, if any? And the GDP figure is only going to sharpen that debate.
Thank you, George, and thank you, Ram. In this week's magazine, I've written a very long essay, as it happens, about the art history of tattoos, asking the question, will a tattoo ever hang in the Louvre? And one of the things I've done in that is talk to two academics who study tattoos. One of them is Gemma Angel, who is researching a collection of 19th and 20th century skins that are kept by the Wellcome Collection. The other is Matt Lodder, who has a PhD from the University of Reading about body modification as artistic practice. Earlier, I spoke to him about whether tattoos can be art. So, Matt, first of all, if you could tell me, what does a tattoo art historian do?
Well, there's a few of us around the world, probably a good kind of cabal of about 10 of us, and what we're all trying to do really is reboot the historical record, really. There's lots of terrible stuff in the past 100 or so years on tattooing, and so we're really, most of us, going back to primary sources, hunting around in archives, chatting to tattoo artists, looking at private collections, reassessing all of the historical material, and really trying to rewrite this history right the way from the from the prehistoric times to the present day, rather than relying on all the myths and misconceptions and misunderstandings that have really crept into the.
And I'm afraid that, it turns out that I've been guilty of perpetuating one of those myths. So since we spoke, you found out that Jenny Churchill, Winston Churchill's mother, didn't in fact have a dragon or a snake round her wrist. That's right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is one of those myths that was kind of about as solid as it gets in terms of the contemporary documentation. It's in all of the, it's in lots and lots of tabloid reports at the end of the 19th century. So we have a good primary source, secondary source material from the time that she was living, which basically very quickly had little drawings and of her tattoo around her wrist, and stories how she got it and stuff. And so that's pretty much been an accepted fact in my field a long time. But a historian called Amelia Clem Osterud, who works in Milwaukee, and he wrote a really good book on tattooed women, was just all bothered by this. She didn't actually primary evidence. Mm. So she went looking for pictures of Jenny. She went looking for her archives and her letters mentioned in her accounts, and nothing seems to ever pop up. And every single photo of her when she was younger, she either had some jewellery over her wrist. And this is often part of the myth that Jenny would cover her tattoo when in polite company with some kind of jewellery. And in all these pictures, she had arms or she had jewellery over her wrist. And so it's really hard to see. And Amelia spent hours and hours and hours looking at photos. And eventually she found a high-res, decent copy of a photograph of Jenny in her later life when she was an old lady with both of her wrists exposed and completely bare of any tattoo at all. So this, even sort of one of the most well-known facts, so to speak, tattoo history, and not true. I mean, she may well have been tattooed, but if she was, it certainly wasn't on her wrist.
Are you still confident about the future Tsar Nicholas II and the future George V going off to China on a sort of gap year?
Yeah, absolutely. So George V, we know because it's in his own account. One of his attendants and manservants, so to speak. So we have primary evidence, and Nicholas as well. So that's one of the ones that we can trace back. And the same true of Edward VII. We know that Edward VII, from his own writing, was definitely tattooed in Jerusalem in 1862. Although there are lots of stories being tattooed after that, being tattooed in London, lots of London tattoo artists in the 19th century advertised they'd been the personal tattoo artist to the king. Actually, we can't find any primary evidence of him ever actually having any more tattoos after 1862. Although, again, those myths kind of do exist in your parliament places.
And to bring it up to the present day, who, in your opinion, are the most kind of, in the artistic tradition, who are the most artistically interesting tattooists working today?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, it depends on what you call artistic, whether we're talking kind of virtuosity and skill. Some incredible artists who, like a guy called Nico, for example, or Mike Davis, those who work in America, who do very, very detailed photorealistic portraits. There are kind of really interesting conceptual tattooers, and someone like Amanda Wachob in Montreal, who does almost like kind of jagged expressionist or kind of brushstroke tattooing. There's loads of kind of really strange, surrealist tattoos coming out. Someone like Ron Henry Wells.
And I should probably at this point give a fairly decent plug for your blog, which is fantastic, which is mattlodder.tumblr.com.
I do try and post stuff that I come across, yeah.
And I've seen some great vintage photos on there and other stuff. Thank you, Matt, for talking to us. It's been really interesting, and thanks for appearing. I'm joined by Nicky Wolfe, who's been blogging for The New Statesman from America, although he's now over here in Britain with us.
Hi.
Hello. You spent the election campaign in the bustling metropolis of Hicksville, Ohio. Mm-hmm. What was the idea behind that?
It was because Ohio was the crucible of the election. The whole thing was predicted to be decided by Ohio. The electoral maths, just kind of the electoral math, as they say, was pretty much brought it down to Ohio, and it did in the end come down to Ohio. So when Ohio got called, the election got called. So that was the way it went. But I wanted to go, rather than somewhere like Columbus or one of the industrial towns, I wanted to go somewhere a bit more out in the sticks and see what real Ohioans with bunny ears were thinking of the election. But in fact, actually, Hicksville is quite a middle class, quite developed town. People were quite wealthy. They did fine wine tastings and things like that. So
it
wasn't
as hick
as I was expecting.
Bored of the election, weren't they? Because they got hammered with TV ads, with billboard ads, everything.
I had some friends out there who I met, and I went for dinner at theirs a few times. And during one dinner, just during dinner, they received 5 auto calls from various political parties, the kind of the main ones, and then the sort of pressure groups and super PACs and everything. And they just get, at one point, he just picked up the phone, put it on speaker, and it said,
"Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads."
"Hi, this is the most important election in a generation." He just sort of slams the phone down. Like, this is ridiculous. They can't watch television because every ad break is constantly political attack ads all the way through. So it just becomes unwatchable.
And you mentioned super PACs there, which is still something that's only slightly on the edge of, I guess, our consciousness in Britain. And I just wonder if you can kind of explain a little bit more about the relevance of them in that election.
Super PAC came out of a piece of legislation called Citizens United, which is badly, badly misnamed, because effectively what it means is that big American money, and a lot of these, you've heard of the Koch brothers and
so they're the kind of Tea Party funders, basically.
Yeah, can put up money to run ads in a political election without it being known to anyone, without having to reveal where the money is coming from. So there are these huge, mysteriously funded groups. Karl Rove's is one of the biggest. And it's known that Karl Rove runs it, but it's still not really known where a whole load of his money is coming from. People can vaguely work it out, but no one has to say anything.
So essentially,
about
you give your money to the super PAC, and then the super PAC happens to spend it on campaigning for a candidate. I think Stephen Colbert, the satirist who used to be on The Daily Show, had one that's sort of...
He started like, a superbank, yeah.
Building a better tomorrow or something like that. And then to bring it a little bit up to date, we were talking earlier about immigration reform being the kind of big debate. And so John McCain has been trying to push this legislation for decades now. So what's happened with that now?
John McCain is the senator from Arizona, and his Arizona local party, I mean, it's wrong to say constituency because it's Arizona, it's huge, but it's put through legislation basically saying that anyone Latino looking can be stopped on the street and have their immigration papers checked. And obviously the entire Latino population of Arizona has been up in arms about this. And it's turned Arizona from a pretty solid Republican state into one that's very much up in the air. It's still in the end went Republican in the last election, but there's no guarantee that it will in the next one as the Latino population grows and as kind of anger grows in that community. So McCain, being reasonably wise as a politician, as any someone who's lost like he has can be, has suddenly realised that, look, we've really got to do something about this.
And that's kind of the same story that you wrote about for the magazine about Texas, about the kind of the rise of the Hispanic vote, how that's really changed the electoral maths, because you've got a constituency that generally tends to have been quite socially conservative, but has been so alienated by the incredibly hard line the Republicans have taken on immigration. And you made a kind of confident prediction that this was going to, this could completely screw the Republican Party unless they tackle it.
Almost to the point where, because Obama is now getting on top of the immigration reform, so if he looks like the one who's putting through immigration reform, that's about the last chance the Republicans have to redeem themselves. So really, it sounds counterintuitive because it's Texas, it's kind of gung ho, it's, you know, yee-haw, but it's really not. And the demographics mean it'll be majority Latino by depending on. If there's zero net immigration, it'll be majority Latino anyway, just by birth rates by 2030. It'll be even sooner than that by if migration continues at the rate it's been. And if migration continues to increase, it'll be even sooner still. That won't translate into politics quite so quickly because that generation has to turn 18. When it does, it is pretty much game over. I mean, that's it for the Republicans, basically.
Thank you, Nikki.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Philip Moore, and I'm joined by Jonathan Derbyshire, the culture editor at The New Statesman. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Phil.
We're going to talk about our Spring Books special, which this week in the magazine kicks off with a review by John Gray of a collection of philosophical essays by Fernando Pessoa, who I was not really familiar with before reading this essay. How did it come about, Jonathan?
The implication of your question, Phil, is that it's not the most obvious choice for the Lee Brook Review in our Spring Book special, and I would cop to that. This was actually a suggestion of John himself. Pessoa, as some listeners may know, was a Portuguese poet and writer who wrote under a dizzying number of pseudonyms. And this collection, Philosophical Essays, a critical edition, is the first complete edition of Pessoa's prose writing. And it's very clear that from John's review that he sees in Pessoa a kindred spirit, particularly in Pessoa's indifference to the canons and procedures of normal academic philosophy. There's a lovely remark towards the end of John's review where he draws a distinction between the way academic philosophy proceeds today, that's to say, by trying to persuade readers of a set of premises or a set of beliefs. Pessoa, John says, is something else. Far from trying to persuade anyone of any set of convictions, he used philosophy to liberate the mind from belief.
And he sounds quite astonishing, because when you hear the sort of biographical detail, his life sounds utterly uneventful, and it seems almost that out of that he kind of, you know, he has this, I don't know, this kind of fractured inner life. You know, he creates these heteronyms, he calls them, his fractured selves. He sounds astonishing.
The work is both in poetry and in philosophical prose is an exploration of this fractured nature of the self, and I think Pessoa ended up with a view of Salford not unlike that of the great Scottish philosopher David Hume, for example, who thought there was no such thing as a stable metaphysical entity called the self, but rather that the self was simply a bundle of perceptions. And I think Pessoa, I'm not entirely sure whether he was familiar with Hume's work, ended up holding to a very similar position.
Yeah, a writer for our times, then, in a strange sort of a way. Another very important book that's coming out this week is John le Carré's new novel, A Delicate Truth, which has been reviewed by Sarah Churchwell for us.
Yes, and now Sarah gives the book a somewhat ambivalent reception, and I think her review is very interesting for the way she charts the mutations in le Carré's work over the course of his career. Now, he's best known, and indeed owes his reputation, to the spy thrillers that he wrote during the Cold War. And Sarah makes a very interesting observation, which is that although those books were written at a time of intense ideological polarisation, they nevertheless were characterised and shaped by a deep degree of moral ambiguity. Mm. Whereas after the fall of the Berlin Wall, le Carré's fiction has begun to traffic, oddly, in a kind of moral absolutism, is if you like. The moral ambiguity has disappeared. I think Sarah is arguing so has some of the charm and interest of le Carré's fiction.
Yes, and a sort of marginal kind of patriotism almost seems to be emerging. She sort of picks apart a large section from the novel, his kind of Merry England moment almost.
Yes, that's particularly striking. And in other of his more recent novels, that patriotism has been has come out as a kind of curdled anti-Americanism, which is not to say that the novel is completely without interest, because I think any le Carré novel is going to have some interest. And she does conclude that the final paragraph of the book, the gist of which she doesn't give away, naturally, alone makes, she writes, A Delicate Truth worth reading, not only for the obvious pleasures to be offered by a master of suspense, but for the brutal truth he forces her to confront at the story's end. So the bottom line is that le Carré, for all the faults of his recent fiction, remains a master of suspense.
Absolutely. In your bookshops this weekend, and probably on your cinema screens in about a year's time, I would imagine.
Yep.
Shakespeare, there are a great many pretenders to the crown. Jonathan Bate has written about this new book. I've heard a lot of buzz about this book. We're all familiar with sort of, you know, the conspiracy theories. You know, that the Earl of Oxford, of course, is said to be have penned them in Roland Emmerich's film Anonymous, which came out last year. It's a great review. It kind of it helps along the argument of the book, I think.
It's a Dr. Johnson-style refutation, as Johnson famously refuted the idealism of Bishop Berkeley. It's a Dr. Johnson-style refutation, demolition, in fact, of conspiracy theories about the authorship of Shakespeare's plays. The book itself is edited by Paul Edmondson and Stanley Wells. It's called Shakespeare Beyond Doubt. Mm. And it's a series of essays which assembles more or less, if you believe Jonathan Bate at least, more or less irrefutable evidence that Shakespeare was, in fact, really Shakespeare. And one particularly interesting aspect to me of Jonathan Bate's review, and listeners will know that Bate is a leading expert on Shakespeare's plays and indeed Tudor literary history more generally. Bate points out that a prominent anti-Stratfordian, and by anti-Stratfordian we mean someone who thinks that Shakespeare was not the author of the plays normally attributed to him, we discover, according to Bate, that a prominent anti-Stratfordian once shared a platform with David Irving, the Holocaust denier, at a so-called revisionist historical conference. And that's a rather unsettling confluence of two forms of conspiracy theory.
It certainly is. And there's a line in the review which any reading I've done into this in the past is kind of where I've come down on this argument as well. Bate writes, "It all boils down to snobbery, the conviction that genius could not have come from a lowly place." And I think we'd probably leave that one at there. What are your other highlights in books this week?
Simon Heffer has reviewed Roger Hermiston's book about the spy George Blake, who was convicted in the early 1960s and sentenced to 42 years for betrayal of his country. Claire Loudon, who's a very interesting new and young literary critic who started writing for The New Statesman recently, reviews Tessa Hadley's new novel, Clever Girl. Mm. Andrew Adonis reviews Michael Waterhouse's biography of Sir Edward Grey, who was the disastrous and inept British Foreign Secretary at the time of the outbreak of the First World War. And I've interviewed the Chilean author Isabel Allende about her new novel, Maya's Notebook.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I'm joined by Alex Hearn, our resident young person's internet social media correspondent, to talk about the second biggest social media story of the week after me leaving Twitter, which was Reddit's, I think you described it as Reddit's racist Where's Wally in trying to attempt to find the two bombers who caused such carnage at the Boston Marathon. So first of all, can you just tell us what happened? How did Reddit get involved in this case?
Well, basically, I mean, the interesting thing about the Boston Marathon bombing, one of the things, is that there were a huge number of photographs of the marathon, of the, you know, the scene before and after the explosions went off, which means that the bombers were inevitably caught on film. And someone at Reddit had the smart idea of setting up the Find Boston Bombers subreddit, where the enormous community at Reddit would pore over the pictures and try and find the Boston bombers and help the police and catch them early. And the problem is, of course, that Reddit didn't really know anything about the Boston bombers. They didn't know what they looked like. They didn't know what the explosives looked like. So they just had to go on profiling. And what you saw in the first few days of it was a huge number of people picking out people with brown skin and backpacks, just going on, you know, going on what is the standard profile of people who have bombed Western countries in the last 10 years. But most of the people they picked had absolutely nothing to do with it. Yeah. One pair of people, it's impossible to know whether the chain started at Reddit or not, but one pair of men were Moroccan American runners who were at the marathon because they're runners. And they ended up on the front page of the New York Post.
Which was an absolutely incredible kind of old... I mean, this story has been represented as being very much about the lack of verification on new media, but that shows you that there can be a similar approach from old media.
Right,
as well.
And I mean, actually, to Reddit's credit, by the time it ended up in the New York Post, Reddit was certain that it wasn't, that those two guys had nothing to do with it. Reddit had done their stalking, found their Facebook pages. They were runners, they were pretty clearly there for legitimate reasons.
But one of the saddest things was the kind of monstering of an Indian student, originally right. Indian-American student at Princeton called Sunil Tripathi, who, as I understand it, a body's been found in a river that they think might be his. But there were days when it was suggested that because he'd gone missing, this was suspicious, and people left comments on his family's tribute Facebook page.
Not days. It was actually, as with all of these things, moved so incredibly fast. It was about 12 hours. But those 12 hours caused a lot of damage. Someone had, shortly after the FBI released photos of the bombers, someone had pointed out that they look a bit like, one of them looked a bit like Sunil Tripathi. And then, again, we don't know what the possible mechanism is, but Sunil Tripathi's name came up on the Boston police scanner.
Which I still think is probably because someone on the Boston Police Department reads Reddit. Right?
Exactly,
I
mean, this is the thing.
Tens of thousands of people do.
The scanner is there just where police talk about everything that is possible. It's not verified in any way.
And the interesting thing being that in America it's legal to listen to a police scanner, whereas it's illegal in Britain.
It is, so you get this sort of thing. And then, of course, when it was reported that his name came up on the scanner, Reddit did a post saying Reddit's found the Boston bomber, linked back to the earlier one, made it on the front. Again, I say Reddit, someone on Reddit upvoted it, the Reddit community. And
but what's quite unprecedented here is that there was an apology on Reddit.
Yeah, this is the interesting thing. Not just an apology on Reddit. The moderator of the Boston Bomber, the Fine Boston Bombers subreddit, apologised, but actually Reddit's general manager apologised, which is kind of unprecedented for them because, of course, the Reddit corporation that runs it likes to emphasise the fact that it is community driven. They're very hands off. It's all very libertarian. So apologising for it is kind of a sign of maturity. It's Reddit has grown up a bit and accepted that Reddit, the company, has some responsibility for what goes on in Reddit, the community.
Well, I would say that, but funnily enough, from a link yesterday that somebody sent me, I went to Reddit's r/beatingwomen subreddit, where people post pictures of women being hit and not consensually. This isn't a kind of S&M thing. This is a people inflicting unconsensual violence on women. And yet Reddit's approach to that is, hey,
still very libertarian. It's our community has set this up. And I mean, part of this might just be, you know, the Reddit general manager, the Reddit business side of the company is, you know, Silicon Valley. young white men who can see things like the direct harm caused by falsely labelling someone a terrorist, but can't see the indirect harm caused by spreading attitudes of hatred against women. Mm. But yeah, you know, if you start apologising for things that the community has done, you have to start apologising for everything the community has done. And r/beating women is one of them.
Yeah, I find it absolutely horrific. That, and owned by Condé Nast, right?
Owned by the company that owns Condé Nast. Yeah, there's so, one further step of disaggregation.
So it's days. Not kind of, this is the thing, I think there's this feeling that Reddit is this kind of crazy wild west that's got nothing to do. But it's a business.
It's a massive internet company. It is some of their money comes from hosting r/beating women.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll talk at length about Reddit because I find it a very fascinating community. Alex Henn, thank you very much.
Thank you, Helen.
Today's podcast was presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Raphael Baer, Caroline Crampton, Jonathan Derbyshire, George Eaton, Alex Hearn, Philip Morn, and Nikki Wolf. It was produced by Yo Zushi, and our theme music is taken from Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.